Hello and welcome to the Innovation and Financial Inclusion podcast. My name is Andrew Wallace and I'm a graduate researcher at Community Finance Solution here at the University of Salford.
I'm Dr. Paul Vick and I'm a senior research fellow and lead researcher at Community Finance Solutions. We're an independent research unit specializing in financial inclusion and community finance, and our mission is to promote access to affordable and ethical finance for the financially excluded by conducting applied research.
So this podcast will aim to bring awareness to innovative and emerging solutions that seek to combat financial exclusion, and at the same time looking to share lessons with practitioners, funders and policymakers to inform policy and practice.
And really, innovation is sort of been a central part of our work going back to the foundation of the unit. Bob Patterson, who was then a housing association manager, came to the university in the 1990s to research new solutions to widespread financial exclusion. And the result of that work was the launch of Community Finance Solutions, but also the setup of a new generation of community finance institutions. And today we're talking with the co-founder of Community Finance Solutions, Carl Dayson, to learn a little bit about what he learned from this experience and what he thinks the implications are going forward. Carl, can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your research interests?
So I'm Carl Dayson. I'm Pro Vice Chancellor for Research and Enterprise at the University of Salford, a post which I've held now for 3 and a bit years. I've worked at the university for quite a long time. And going back when I first started, it was as a researcher with a couple of colleagues, one called Bob Patterson, the other called James Powell. James was a former Pro Vice Chancellor at university back in the day, but Bob was really the lead of the unit, and Bob focused on issues around financial exclusion as they were emerging then, and the search for solutions, and Bob and I worked on that for a period of time. And what we were looking at, I suppose, was twofold, and things we didn't realise at the time. We were looking at an environment of the mid-1990s, and, stop me if this becomes familiar, but we had a long-term Conservative government that seemed to be in its dog days of its time of office. We had major economic crises that seemed to mean that there was virtually no money for anything. And there were underlying structural inequalities that just had gone unaddressed for an awful long time. And so if you looked at Salford, for example, you had stories of people with mortgages that, huge negative equity on those mortgages, to the point where it wasn't unknown for people to essentially just post their keys in the bank's door and say, I've had it, take it away from me, because actually the debt is too great and I can't afford it and I'm better off not paying this mortgage and trying, etc. People would buy houses, swap deeds in the pub, because you could buy a house for £5,000. It's a terraced house. In fact, in some parts in Liverpool, you could do it for £1. So it almost became like buying cars. I mean, today you think that's incredible, but actually that was not unusual. There was a genuine sense of public realm disrepair in many, many urban areas, and a sense that the government just didn't have any answers on that side of it. And when you looked into it, there was widespread use of of legal money lenders. So the provident were huge, and so door-to-door collection was quite prevalent, really, in many poor neighbourhoods. And the only solution that politicians had were really around credit unions. And they were saying, well, credit unions can pick up the slack. And I think there was a lot of sense of the credit unions, and then it became a very popular thing, credit unions, etc. My PhD was on, it's interesting, yours, Andrew's about history of economics. My PhD was on demutualisation of the building societies, and this is a paradox of demutualisation of the building societies at the same time as the support for credit unions. It's like, well, we think one answer is mutualisation, but the other answer, we don't want mutualisation. and I sort of explored that paradox. But looking at that research, they really, the credit unions weren't that big. There was no evidence they were going to grow to be that size, and the building sites were moving away into a space of privatisation. The irony, of course, is they moved into privatisation, and you look what happened in the crash of, 2008. It was many of those ex-building sites that fell over, because actually it's a different space for them. So there was a huge sort of disconnect widely, and we got funded by Leverhulme to do some work around this issue. And the concept of financial exclusion was there, but it was pretty underdeveloped in the mid-1990s. Everyone recognised there were a number of attributes towards it, the way in which, some people get a bank account, some people couldn't get a bank account, how some people didn't get a bank account because of where they lived. It was known as redlining. You draw a map on on the wall and you say, we don't give anyone a bank account inside branches. That was seen as quite common. Until actually I spoke to a banker who said, it's not called redline, we use a blue pen. That was their argument. That's what the world is dealing with. And, and there was no real pressure on the banks to serve the communities even. It was not there. So we started doing the work, and we found that, in urban areas, there was a lot of financial exclusion, that people had no other option but to go to the moneylender. And the notion the credit union will pick up the slack was nonsense, because the interest rates the credit unions could legally charge at that point, because credit unions were capped, about 12% APR, would no way cover the risk. So when you looked at the successful credit unions, those successful credit unions at the time, were predominantly industrial based. The police, the fire services, and various trade union based credit unions, all doing good stuff, but already serving people, lots of them in the health services, serving people that were already employment. They weren't serving in the community. The credit unions that were serving inside the community were really struggling. It was hand to mouth, because there weren't that many savers for the mutual system to operate from. And therefore they were tended to be quite small. And there was a report that was done by colleagues at Liverpool John Moores, which is a good piece of work, but essentially it said we need to expand the size of the credit unions and merge them and make bigger ones and more citywide ones, and that will make them more sustainable. But from where I sat, that sort of was fundamentally the flawed proposition, because it was like, you're just going to add more unsustainable institutions together to make a bigger unsustainable institution. It's not really addressing the fundamental issue. You haven't really tackled the issue of, they started from how to make credit unions more sustainable, rather from what does the user want, what does the customer want, and then design a model out of that. So Bob and I started doing that research there, and we looked at what's the model, and we started hit upon what was legislation which is back in the 19th century called Industrial and Provident Society Act, which allowed for the creation of loan funds, etc., that were not for profit. So we used that legislation to propose, we should set up some not-for-profit funds, and they should provide a range of services, everything from, services aimed at the very poorest in terms of sort of small-term loans, etc., through to housing-related loans, sort of repairs and stuff like that, because part of the problem with negative equity is no one saw any benefit in changing the windows in their house. So all the things you could do that could actually improve their house, what's the point? I own the house, I've got a £10,000 mortgage, the house is only worth £8,000, why do I spend any more money on it? So even people in private sector weren't going to invest in a really, bad deal on that sense. And the banks weren't going to lend the money for it. There's no equity release, because there's no equity to release. So, and then also into SMEs as well. And again, the same problem with SMEs. If you look at SMEs in poorer neighbourhoods, they really struggle. And they struggle, especially those that serve in those neighbourhoods, because, of course, their client group is poor, and therefore they can only do so many things. The reason why you see those sort of small corner shops cling on, or if there was those, et cetera, was because that's their client base. It's a function of the client base. And therefore, they also were starting to drop out. And as the banks start to withdraw from those communities, it just sort of becomes cyclical. And the only thing left by the mid-1990s, or seemed to be the only thing left, seemed to be the only thing that seemed to be surviving, were, money shops, etc., or, as it replaced the banks, and then things like, hairdressers or tanning studios. And there's nothing wrong with those businesses, but that's it. You see parades of shops and half of them blocked up, and everything are gone. It's a real sense of disrepair. So we did the piece of work and proposed these new types of organisations. And I think it was a conversation we had sort of in the closing stages of the research. We focused on Portsmouth and Salford. And it was really a conversation with one of the banks, I think a senior executive of Barclays, if I'm rightly, who said to us, this is really great. Now, can you build them? Now, Bob's background is in housing association. So actually he came from the private, he came from that sector. So he was used to buildings, you know, used to know what he was doing on that side of it. For me, it was completely new. It was like, build it. I'm a researcher, I don't build anything. It's not what I do, you know. I just put these ideas out there and hopefully somebody by osmosis will pick up and run with it, you know. I had no sense of where that was going to go. So, and then they said, well, you know, actually, we're restructuring, you know. The banks were restructuring as well. And they were so basically getting rid of a lot of their branches. Or mostly what they really did at that stage was getting rid of a lot of their middle management. So a lot of regional branches were going, the regional managers, etc., were being sort of shifted out. And they had a whole raft of workforce that were in the sort of mid-50s, etc. Good people, good bankers, but actually they didn't need any more, you know, and they just didn't. And they were trying to work out ways to sort of get them to either retirement or get them sort of to move on to different. They were quite paternalistic. They wanted to support them through this transition, you know. So, and they thought there was an opportunity where they could seconded some of the bankers that were leaving the bank to these organisations who would help set them up and then they would run them, which is exactly what we did. And we got the money for one in Portsmouth, which was with Lloyds Bank, and in Salford was with Barclays Bank. And we did exactly that. We basically had a secondee from the banks, whose job it was to set up. We set up the organisational structure and sort of what we called a promote and float model. So the university sort of took the risk to start with and then handed it over to the community organisation. They ran the business and they would stand and fall on their own performance. And that was it. As always, with any good idea, you put it out there and things don't follow as you expect it to follow. And the enterprise stuff proved really difficult. And I think part of the reason it proved really difficult was that there was an awful lot of other money the government had changed by then, Labour had come in. And the Labour government had started to put money into enterprise. So therefore there was pretty competing for pots and stuff like that on that side of it. However, the personal finance stuff was really, really popular. But the problem was, just couldn't make it stack up, you know. It was always losing money, you know, etc. And the interest rates had to go up, and that ran into a huge political problem. And the huge political problem was that people didn't like high interest rates, you know. And we ran into this sort of problem, which I always say is that the financial services policy, in terms of public policy, is viewed from middle class lens. So we always look at it from our own perspectives. Those that talk about it, whether they be academics or whether they be NGOs or whether they be activists in some form or politicians, always related to their own experience. So therefore, I can get a mortgage, why can't you get a mortgage?
Because I guess I remember Bob always telling stories about having, because he was the head of housing association, so he would have new tenants moving in from furnished to unfurnished accommodation and then taking out high cost loans to fill their house with sort of essential items, and then a few weeks down the line being in arrears with the rent, and then having to, for the housing association, was also sort of a costly procedure then to go through, and obviously awful for the family. And I think also sort of the cost is only part of it also, which was what the Financial Conduct Authority found when they did an investigation into commercial high cost credit, was that customers had really poor outcomes as well. It's also about the, you know, how they are trying to get them to borrow more and more, and how there's been whereas the idea with, I guess, what you were setting up with them was sort of more around trying to reducing the interest rate was part of it, a really important part of it, but there were also other aspects around trying to support households to reduce their, well, to save a little bit, to take steps to improve their financial position, really.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. You could, you know, I suppose where we envisioned we would get to is that you would then sort of start to a relationship with local shops or with business and actually get vouchers so people could say, actually, you know, yes, you can get slightly cheaper, and with that additional money, there's some savings here as well. Could we get them linked into a savings account? The really successful one, I think, was what was East Lakes Moneyline became Moneyline, where we had a savings partnership with the Bank of Scotland, I think it was, if I remember rightly. And that meant they people could, and essentially what they did there was really, really simple, was when you took the loan out, you say the loan repayments a week were, you know, £8.25, for argument's sake, they'd top it up to say £9, and the 75p would go in your savings account. You wouldn't notice a save, but gradually over time, you would start to accumulate your own income, you know, and it was about getting people into those sort of, you know, those better behaviour efforts, alongside things like debt advice. People borrowed all sorts of stuff that really shouldn't have paid back and stuff like that. But it was always became this thing about debt. When it came to debt, it wasn't just, you know, the housing association. It was people would pay who put the pressure on the most. And the moneylenders knew this. So they were there on the door asking for the money, and that became, I pay them. The fact that actually they should pay the gas bill first was, you know, it was actually, but the gas bill aren't chasing them like that. Yeah. So the wrong people were being paid, and people were taking the wrong advice on who should be paid as well. And very few people understand the way in which this sort of operates the way through. So you need to get people really good advice so that they can start to make those right decisions. And then gradually you get them out of the scenario they're in. That takes time. But you know, the more you focus on that interest rate of being, oh, we must have a child 10%, that's a cost. You know, you either someone has to pay that. And this is the problem criticising the banks. And I have a lot of sympathy for the banks around this space, because the banks didn't go into this market precisely because they saw the reputational risk. Because they knew they couldn't make this stack up at 10 or 12%, not in a month of Sundays. The cost of setting up the account alone would be too much. And, you know, these customers would go into arrears. They would miss weekly payments. You know, that's what would happen. They'd rather pay in cash. They wanted to use a branch. All these are costs that someone has to incur. You know, and it's fine saying, oh, the banks are rich and they incur it. But actually, we need to take them a step back and go, this is the right vehicle here. You know, how are we helping them? You know, so the banks would get bashed and the moneylenders would get bashed. But there really wasn't, and there still isn't, in a sense of actually, how do we move beyond where we are? You know, what are we trying to achieve here? What's the purpose that we're trying to achieve? And if we want to achieve financial inclusion is, I've always said this, is a ladder. You know, and then on ladders, you do things in stages. You don't think, right, I'm going to climb a ladder by jumping on that top step. You know that you've got to get people back there, and therefore you need to build an infrastructure that enables people to get this out. If you want cheap interest rates, fine, then tell me who subsidises it and where's that money coming from. Otherwise, you're setting people up for fail in the long term, because those institutions will fall over. You know, but there's this sort of refusal to sort of accept sort of financial reality of it, and that sort of works its way through. And what we were trying to do over the years was sort of make this case. And actually what I think the case was made in the end is the sense that people really wanted these services. You know, there were no complaints from the customers about these services, about the cost and the rest of it, and the customer numbers went up across different institutions across the country. There's a real desire for it. You know, we could have, if we'd had the resources, we could have built a national profile with them and et cetera, and that's, I always look back and think, that's the thing. The issue was always the sort of collective nervousness about, and that. So while we've surrounded all the services, all the debt advice, I think there is still a chance to do that. But it's interesting now, that today, I think we're back there.
Mm-hmm. But how many did you... So you set up one in Portsmouth and Salford?
About 10 in the end.
About 10.
Yeah.
And what do you sort of... how would you reflect on... What do you think have you learned from setting up those 10, looking back? What do you think sort of worked well? What do you think you could have perhaps done differently?
I think what worked well was, I think, handing over local control. You know, I think that decision was the right decision. I still think it is not the university's job to run and manage these. These are supposed to be community organisations. So by doing that, of course, that means that some of them were more successful than others and some weren't very successful at all. But I don't see that as a problem. I think that's should be allowed. And a free market system, you know, applies just as much to the not-for-profit sector as it does to the for-profit sector. I'm a big fan of that in that sense. In other words, you know, innovation means there's failure. Mm. Innovation does not mean there's success. And where there is failure, that means that organisations will fall over, and that is not the end of the world, and we shouldn't sort of think that every single time there has to be success, because that's not a thing. The advantage with these sort of organisations is they didn't have anyone's savings. So if the organisation fell over, the risk to the individual borrower was relatively little, because they had to borrow, actually they might actually get away with it, so they'll be fine, you know. But, you know, but generally speaking, the risks were to institutions that invested in them, the government, etc. So all people, all organisations that could sustain the risk. So there wasn't much societal risk on that side of it. I also think it was positive in the sense that the community saw something that was for them, that there was a new shop opening that was different to everything else along the parade. It was offering a different type of service and seemed to be talking to their needs rather than something else. So I think those are really positive things. And there's no doubt in my mind, and looking at success in particular, things like Moneyline, you know, that, you know, there were always customers. Yeah, you could always get customers and that wasn't the real issue, you know, et cetera. You know, the challenge was always, and this is the difficult part, is you could always get customers, but you had to have enough money. And that was always the big shit challenge for all those organisations, was could they get enough lending capital? Mm. So they spent most of their lives, even the successful ones, the chief execs, chasing the next couple of million pounds for the following Christmas. So it's always the way that all the organisations were the same. They all had a big peak of lending in round about now, October through to November, yeah, end of November, as families wanted to have a really decent Christmas.
Yeah.
So that's when the lending cycle would always be there. And then there'd be a drop off in January and spend most of the new year paying off the debt so they could do it again all over again in the thing. And that pattern went on. And I think that's the right pattern. I think the problem was is that getting lenders to lend the money, because of course, you know, the repayments were always patchy and those lenders didn't want higher and higher interest rates either. So there was a sort of always a trade-off between that sort of space. You know, how much risk would then the lenders get all their money back? And in some cases, they weren't going to get their money back. And so I think another thing is we never really got the guarantees up and running. What I really wanted, I think what would have helped is if there'd been really good guarantees from government that underwrote some of the money. So actually, you could have then gone to the banks and said, you know, okay, you're going to give us, you know, £10 million. We fully expect, you know, £2 million of that to disappear because the risk you're taking. So that's going to go. So you just accept that. But that's all right because the government's going to give you, offset that risk for you. So that part's gone. So then it's the £8 million. You work with us on that. I think that sort of model would have, you know, and therefore every pound over £8 million we got back, you know, the government would have put some reward system in, so actually to encourage us and the bank to work together to actually increase that and get better return on investment. That, for me, that's sorting out that treasury function, I think, is the really big missed opportunity, and we never got that truly nailed. So the organisation spent too much time, I think, chasing money rather than chasing new customers. And I think it's really interesting, there was one of the bankers that we had, because at the time there's a lot of critique of this notion of shareholder value, about how everyone was, the banks themselves, everyone was just working for institutions to ensure that shareholders got their dividends. And so that was it. So actually we were driven by agendas of dividend and the stock market rather than what's good for the business. And one of the bankers said to me, he said, this is no different. You know, instead of shareholders, we've got lenders, you know, and what we're doing is we're shaping our business to suit the lenders. We're not shaping it to suit the customers. It's the lenders that are driving this business model. And this, so what's the difference in that shareholder value? And I thought, you know, he was right. Fundamentally, he was right. So I think that's one of, for me, that I look back and say that wasn't it. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that we probably should have done it at scale to start with, you know, but I think you needed that sort of, you were always going to pilot, so there's always a bit of that. But that's all for the organisations to do.
Mm-hmm. See, that in Europe, there's obviously lots more of having... There's a few models where they have one single large institution that's much more linked into it. But
that only works if the state is on board.
Yeah.
You know, and the UK state never really got on board. Well, it got on board because it wanted individual institutions rather than... It was looking a lot to the American model and it was saying, well, here's CDFIs in the United States. Can we have that replicated in the UK rather than saying... You know, actually, it's a different model. The irony, of course, is there is a model in the UK they could have adopted that's been long-standing, which is the Prince's Trust. You think about the Prince's Trust is long-standing, doing small loans to startups in many deprived areas, young people in particular. And, you know, great work by what was then Prince of Wales, now the King, etc., on setting that up and over many, many years, and very, very successful. I think if the government had looked towards that sort of scheme and said, that national model we need around financial exclusion, sort of Prince of Wales for financial excluded, I think it could have been done. But they looked too much towards the United States and went, what we want is CDFIs. And one of the attraction, I think, of the CDFI model, and again, I don't want to hold this against politicians or anyone who's involved in it, was they weren't just about loans. They were actually helping to regenerate inner cities. Mm-hmm. And that was attractive to the UK government, the Labour government as well, because actually they did want these inner cities regenerated. And that was a way of lifting up some of that. That was missed. The other thing I'd say is Britain's really difficult thing about savings and loans, and how it's almost impossible to set a financial institution up that does both. You know, you've got so much capital in terms of lending criteria, and that just got worse after 2008, because of course then it was, you know, every small institution is a risk, which, you know, the irony here for me was, yeah, they are, but they're not systemic risk. The risk isn't, you know, one of the small CDFIs or one of the small credit unions falls over. That's not a risk. The national finances is not going to collapse because of that. On the other hand, one of the big four banks falls over, that's systemic risk. But what we'll do is we'll allow them to do everything and do everything, even stuff that is really high risky. But these institutions, we won't allow to take any risk whatsoever.
Mm.
And then we say when they fall over, oh, that proves it. It's like, no, you just actually set them up to fail. That's what it's proven. You know, it doesn't actually proven that these institutions are more successful.
Yeah, because you have lots of, obviously, in America, where you do still, to some degree, you have community banks and smaller banks, and still have some compartmentalization of the financial market. Obviously, they fall over, you know, all the time. I think I was reading that every credit union folds every day in America. Yeah. So that's sort of quite substantial, really.
Well, and the savings and loan crisis in America as well, which is quite common. And, you know, and the UK system has held up as a really big system all the way through the early part of our research in 2008, of course. And at which point it realised that, you know, that we had massively concentrated our resources in a few institutions. And when they started to wobble, there was nothing. There was literally the Bank of England, and that was it, you know. And you know, I know that if you look, you know, George Osborne's notes, you know, sort of stuff, etc., and the bank, and they say at the time, you know, they were a weekend away from basically ATM machines not being able to work. You know, it was really Gordon Brown's interventions. And you think, how do you get to that stage? You know, that we never had a diverse system. We never had a system that was, there was enough competition. New actors found it difficult to come into the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And I think there is still a fundamental issue, the way in which the UK financial system is operating, which makes it inherently problematic.
I think it's because there's a real benefit to banks of being too large, too big to fail, because essentially there's a big inherent sort of subsidy built into that, which is quite substantial and gives them a big competitive advantage. But the idea was always that that would be, there'd be, you know, on the one hand, the banks would do, you know, the government would provide X, and then the banks would uphold their thing about providing and serving broader markets and doing, you know, because there's a recognition that financial services was not like producing pens or, you know, iPads or whatever. So yeah, I think definitely that sort of the lack of a sort of social contract between banks, government, and community finance providers, and like what each of them do and how they work together, I think is lacking. So
yeah,
so when you started talking about at the start, I did feel a bit of a deja vu in terms of the context and all of that. So, you know, what do you think are some of the key areas in terms of policy and research in this area? What do we need to address? What are some of the problems?
So there are many similarities, but there is one striking difference, and I think we should not underestimate the striking difference. The big striking difference was that when we started looking at work in the 1990s, there were still large amounts of structural unemployment. So you were still doing large amounts of population that didn't have access to work or any work, employment whatsoever. So unemployment was rife, benefits, really, you know, lots and lots of people on benefits, etc. When you look today, what I note is that levels of employment are high by any measure. And I saw this morning's figures are even higher, etc. but levels of pay are awful. And there has not been a significant pay rise for the last decade, since the crash, essentially. You know, wages have essentially stagnated. And so we're in a difficult situation. So the usual government interventions about how do we, it's really interesting, the government talks about growing the economy, and that work, I would think that would work really well in an environment where you have high unemployment, because you want to push, you need supply into the system, new firms set up, they'll start employing some of those people, training skills, straightforward. We're in a different situation. Most people have got jobs, and they'll have multiple jobs as well, and they'll run tight incomes, and there's no way any of those jobs are getting paid more and more. How do we find that? So I think that's the sort of public policy dilemma. So it means that, you know, no one can afford anything. So the gap between assets and income has widened. Curiously, despite the fact unemployment benefit is paid so badly, it's actually got harder to get a house when you're in work than it was 10 years ago. You know, it's 12, 11 times income, average house prices now. It was 4 or 5, you know. So it actually becomes, that sort of aspirational part becomes more stretched. So I think in terms of thinking through, people have got to think through what it means for employment, the notion of employment and work and pay. And there's a whole range of work there which I don't think the politicians are anywhere near beginning to want to think that through, and what that looks like. We've got to think through wealth far more and assets. So the big issue is housing, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you've got a house or not, but, you know, if the level of house ownership has collapsed and is continuing to collapse. And that means, you know, everyone thinks, oh, that doesn't really affect the poor, but it does, because what happens is that then people who used to buy a house end up renting a house, and they end up paying more because they can afford more. Although they're not rich, they can afford more than the person, the lowest income, who can't, and they get squeezed always out. And so you have people living with their parents until their 30s and 40s, things that didn't happen, you know. Absolutely. So it's that, it's thinking through those structural issues and working your way through those things. You still have, therefore, and because now, as they say, people are borrowing amongst the means, we can see that sort of credit card debt starting to sneak up again. If we're not careful, that will go through the roof this winter because of energy consumption. There's another issue which we need to address. We have a pension crisis, which we're just seeing, etc. People aren't putting enough in the pension, but they're not going to if they think it's all going to disappear. You know, what's the point? You know, what's the point on that side of it? So there are some real financial mechanisms. I would say that on the positive side, I think there's better sense of where we can go in community building, but I still think the UK fundamentally has a flawed system. We have devolved government in patches, but we don't have devolved financial services. And so there's not a, you know, an ideal world, you want a financial instruments alongside your elected mayor that can work on local economic development, that can actually do stuff, can actually borrow from the money markets. You know, Manchester should have a bond ranking. You know, Manchester should be able to issue bonds, have a bond, you know, have a bond rating, have it ranked, and therefore be able to borrow debt against it to invest in infrastructure it needs. It shouldn't always go back to Westminster and say we want to do this. You know, there are rules you can set up. Other countries seem to manage. Germany manages, America manages. This is not rocket science, and yet in the UK we seem incapable. But we are stuck now in a cycle where there's high national debt. The government needs to get the national debt down. It's only got two ways, which is more taxes or more austerity. It's forsworn on taxes. In fact, it wants to go the opposite direction. It's left with austerity, and we'll have more rounds of austerity to come, which will just suppress wages even more. You know, so I think they're for me, they're the really big issues that I've got to think. So there's a real cost of living crisis out there, I think.
And what does that mean for sort of the community finance sector and the financial inclusion agenda?
I think it's you can say at one time, oh, it's good news because it's going to become politically interest again. I think in the short term it's really bad news, because cost of living will impact on people's ability to repay their existing loans or to take new loans out. Those institutions will feel the brunt of that first. Those institutions will put under more pressure first. No one in government's going to care those institutions fall over. That's just another small institution falling over. And therefore what you're going to see is more pressure on those institutions to begin with. Now, over time, then there'll be a sense of, oh, what do we need to do to actually sort of, what sort of institutions do it? So then they'll reinvent them, of course, in a different form on that side of it. But I think that's what we're, so I think in the short term, this will be pretty bad news, I would suggest, for those institutions. All those institutions will have to go up market. They will end up serving people that are slightly better off, who are falling into that trap for the first time that they never used served before, which means, of course, the people they never used to serve don't get served because the risks start to grow on that side of it. So it's, again, you're leaving it to institutions to make public policy decisions, or decisions that shape public policy. And there isn't, the politician should be there at the centre of this saying, right, actually, Organisation X, we know why you're doing it, but that's okay, we'll underwrite you to do that because we do need to support the very poor.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're not getting that market signal, and they're not getting that signal at all, then they're going to, the only way to survive is to go slightly up market. We saw it with the credit unions. It happened to credit unions. You know, it's, you know, you basically look for more industrial partners to be part of your credit union. You make sure that, you know, you've got a university or access to university payroll system, or, you know, the local hospital, etc. And it's really an attempt to stabilise the financial situation. Institutions make rational decisions. I don't blame any institution for doing any of those things. I would do the same if I was in the chief executive's office. Exactly the right thing to do. That doesn't mean it's right from a public policy perspective. And that's where government have to intervene and have to actually shape that public policy and help institutions do it and do what's right. So I think there are some issues.
I think essentially the first few steps of the ladder are not going to be there.
They're not going to be.
So, and that's quite a big...
And those steps are moving further and further. I mean, that's the problem. They're not going to be there. And, you know, it gets harder and harder. And a decade without a pay rise, which is where Britain has been really in effect now. Actually, it's now more now. It gets a decade and a half, really, since 2010. You know, that gets tougher. Life just gets tougher and tougher for people. And there's no sense of improvement, no sense of getting there. And so you've got an entire generation growing up that actually the majority of which will never own a home.
I think I think it also calls for some more fundamental and more trying out some radical things. I think, like you and Bob did back in the 90s, bit of a call to actually try and, rather than necessarily just provide loans or do other things, you need to sort of think radically more about, I don't know, asset transfer or sort of more radical means of doing things.
Yeah. No, and we have to get to that more creative space. We need to rethink, you know, how do we work? Because it varies to get depressed about this. The great lesson I think I took from those work from Bob and one thing else is that there are always solutions. They may seem mad or impractical or radical or whatever you want to describe them as, but actually times must, and you've got to work through those. There are ways forward, I think, and I think we need to offer people hope. You know, and I think once people get hope, then they can start to see some new options that will come through. At the moment, the problem is there's not enough optimism in the system. So how do we ensure that people feel they've got a better chance? And we always put it back to the individual. We say, can we upskill you or something like that? But that isn't just the system. That's almost like a stick in plaster. It might have that individual, but it's not, you know. So what sort of institutions do we need?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what sort of support do firms need? What's a viable business model to help those firms be successful? You know, and then how do we ensure that people are, you know, getting investment that works for them? So how can we get a system where, you know, I do think, you know, I look back and my parents bought their home, you know, it was a right to buy a home back in the day, so it was discounted, and they had what's known as MIRAS, which is mortgage interest relief tax. So essentially they got tax relief on the mortgage interest. That was standard. So when everyone says in their 70s or 60s, oh, in our day, I haven't got a clue, you know, it's great. Yeah, you had tax relief on your mortgage interest. No one got that today. No. That's absolutely. But I think we might have to go back. I would say we might have to look at those things again to help the next generation step onto that ladder. And therefore, you know, that then gives space for the ones that, you know, are more sort of, you know, more traditional working class that probably couldn't get social housing to move into the social housing, that move into the private rental sector and start. But we are going to need to build more houses. There's no doubt about it. We need more houses being built to get there. But I think that's where I would look at.
So, Andrew, what were your sort of key takeaways from this interview?
So I think my sort of the key overarching point that I got from Carl's interview was that there's still a need for financial inclusion and community financial support, you know, despite the fact that the context has changed between the late 90s when CFS was set up and now, you know, financial exclusion is still widespread, with many people still making use of, or many individuals still making use of high cost credit. You know, sector, you know, at the moment it still makes over 5 million loans a year. And at the same time, you know, comparing with the 90s again, you know, many still have low financial resilience. You know, at the moment, one in five UK households have less than £100 in savings. So I think clearly shows that financial exclusion is growing.
Yeah, I also was struck by this sense of deja vu listening to Carl. You know, in some ways, everything has changed, but nothing's changed. There are still very much widespread exclusion and low financial resilience, and the community finance solutions then as community finance institutions then as now are, you know, are practical ways to try and improve the financial position of low income households. And what struck me about what Carl said is really this is not so much about lofty policy goals, but really about creating community-based lenders where people have few or no viable ethical alternatives, and these are sort of mechanisms to try and put some money into people's pockets by charging a comparatively lower interest rates than what they would get from going to a commercial high-cost credit provider, but also around trying to improve the resilience of residents by linking loans to budgeting support and savings.
Yes, no, I agree. I think that the, you know, the creation of these community-based lenders and development solutions they've used to, you know, to help low-income households, as you stated, are very important. But at the same time, there's a need to design these products that they've created around the needs and preferences of the customers, these, you know, the low-income households. And like you said, you know, they've focused on charging lower interest rates, and that's one part of it. But there's also the other part, as Carl stated, that you need to focus on the, you know, things that are from a customer's perspective are more effective. So that could be flexible repayments, savings linked to loan repayments, income maximisation, so such as benefits checkers, and other advice like budgeting advice and debt advice. And I think a mixture of all these, you know, is very important for any sort of future intervention or solution.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point in terms of that you need to take into account and adjust the services and design the services for based on the needs and preferences of low-income consumers. Otherwise, you won't achieve the scale and impact that you want, really. And but at the same time, I was also struck by what Carl said around that sort of lack of guarantees and other sort of national policies made it very difficult for community finance providers to raise capital to on-lend. And really, I think for me, the key takeaway from that is that if you're going to have an effective financial inclusion and community finance sector, you really need a supportive national framework. In some research we did for Carnegie UK Trust, looking at how to scale up community finance provision, we found that national mechanisms to compel banks to invest in community finance is critical if we're going to achieve a step change in growth of the sector. And if we look in a lot of other countries, there are already frameworks there. For example, in France and America, there is regulation and policy in place to underpin sustained and ongoing investment and support from banks into community finance. And I think that's still missing in the UK.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the sort of having a supportive national framework is very important, especially in helping to provide practical financial inclusion support, especially on a local level. But at the same time, going back to my previous point, I think that needs to be driven more by the needs and preferences of the low-income consumer.
And because of that, we're going to be looking at the needs and issues facing low-income consumers, as well as the innovative solutions in this podcast series. We're going to be talking with leading practitioners and experts, but also offer some of our own thoughts. And the podcast series is going to be split into two. The first half is going to be focused on the problems and issues facing low-income consumers today. And in the second one, we're going to look at some of the innovative practice and interventions that are being implemented in the UK and beyond.
And that's the Innovation in Financial Inclusion podcast with Andy and Paul. Join us next time, where we'll be discussing the realities of managing on a low income. Bye for now.